Welcome to the Lake Superior Podcast. I'm Walt Lindelof.
And I'm Frieda Wara. We are made stronger by story, and there's no better source than the continent's largest body of fresh water, Lake Superior.
So join us as we highlight the five national parks that ring this greatest of the Great Lakes, meet the people, tour the places, and learn about the projects that make these parks and body of water so remarkable.
This podcast made possible with the support of the National Parks of Lake Superior Foundation and Media Brew Communications.
Well, welcome to our podcast. I'm Walt Lindelof. With me, of course, is Frieda Wara. And very exciting, Frieda. We're talking to someone here that has some very unique history with the parks. Tell us about that a little bit there, Frieda.
When you get an opportunity to be in the room, in the Aura, walking a trailer, for me even to be at Isle Royale with her, Phyllis Green will change your life. And certainly the years that she has spent with all of the work that she's done, both with the Forest Service and the National Park Service, we've got over four decades with this woman that's speaking with us today, Walt. And my goodness, let's just get rolling with, and how lucky we are that she lives in Houghton, Michigan.
Yeah, it's Phyllis Green, and she's with us. And Phyllis, let's talk a little bit about that. I mean, you had 41 years of service between the Forest Service, National Parks, and it sounds like you wanted to do this from an early age. Tell us a little bit about your backstory. I understand that you were like 6 years old when you first went to Isle Royale, and that was kind of the start, right?
Yes, I grew up in the Upper Peninsula in Houghton, Michigan, and so my parents were really great about getting us out in the woods. And I do remember my first trip to Isle Royale. I was around 6 years old, and we went on the boat one way, and I think we flew the other way, but it's kind of one of those, if you're 6 year old and the magic of that island just kind of unfolds below you, it's definitely a permanent memory and a very fond one because all of my siblings were there and we had a lot of fun hiking around, getting swimming a little bit, but I want you to know that water is cold enough to turn all your fingernails blue.
Then from there, you kind of went with it and you said you wanted to be a ranger. Tell us about that a little bit.
Well, I knew at an early age, who knows what influence Lassie had, that I wanted to be a forest ranger. And so it was an easy transition to go from Houghton High School to Michigan Technological University, where I graduated with two degrees. One was in forestry, and the other was in communication. So it was a good opportunity to kind of combine my love of the woods with being able to talk about it. So my pursuit has always been a federal career and a forest ranger, which I did in my early years, definitely.
That must have been quite a change, though. I'm thinking back, Phyllis, there probably weren't a lot of women in those positions.
I think every position I held, I was the first woman to hold it.
That's important, I think, to note that you were not only doing something that you wanted to do, but it was also somewhat groundbreaking, wasn't it?
It was, in a sense. Actually, the funny part, when I got into the forestry school here at Tech, you go to the bookstore and pick up a general forestry book. And the one I had was a very early edition, like 1950s. And this is 1970s, late 70s. And it actually had a chapter in it that said, forestry is a man's job for a man. And it even had a chapter in it that discussed looking for the perfect wife, because of course it...
I'm loving it.
Oh yeah. So, and I've kept that book. I went and got the one that was updated because they did get rid of that pretty quickly. But I kept that book, and it's like, we've come a long way. We still have a long way to go. But I feel very fortunate to have had support and met some wonderful people along the length of my career here.
Give us a little bit of the roadmap, because you were on both coasts. How did those things all kind of fall in place?
I have a different career to have ended up in the National Park Service, because I started with the Forest Service actually while I was still in college, and I worked in Minnesota and Michigan, and then I went down and worked in North Carolina. actually came back into Michigan on the Huron-Manistee National Forest. And then I went to Vermont. And then I went out to Colorado. And then, anyway, and I ended up in Washington for a while. And I even took a job as an information officer at the world's largest research lab for forest products down in Madison. So I was very happy, though. I got back into the UP when I became the forest supervisor of the Ottawa National Forest, which is definitely a wonderful million acres on the west end of the Upper Peninsula.
So I have to ask you then, Phyllis, in terms of your career, was it sort of by design, or was it something that was just sort of by happy fortune that you ended up back in the UP?
Well, in the Forest Service, you have to apply and compete in the same way in the Park Service for the jobs that you're interested in. And I'm a dual career family. My husband is a civil engineer, so it was a bit of a, we definitely have to scope out each area that I thought I would enjoy the job and the challenges it presented with opportunities for work for him. And at the time I made it to the Ottawa, I was also applying on the Green Mountain. And I'm happy that I ended up on the Ottawa because it was close to family and it's definitely my back door. I had actually canoed every river that's canoeable on the Ottawa National Forest before I got the job.
You have a history with Isle Royal.
Yep.
Why Isle Royal? What was it about it that was appealing that said, I want to go and do this?
Yeah, it's definitely a cultural shift to have worked for the National Forest Service, which has a full role in natural resource management, from mineral development to roads to timber sales, but also wilderness. And but Isle Royal was too good to pass up. It was a promotion, but that wasn't the primary reason. It's a really pristine national park with tremendous challenges and wonderful natural resources. And it was just a happenstance that I was on the west end of the UP. Plus, I always liked to take a job where I could make a difference. And I felt that I knew Isle Royal well enough. I knew the congressional delegation in Michigan. I knew the local people. And I felt I could help be a bridge to the island, if you will, with both local people and the American public. And it was good timing, and it worked out wonderfully.
We're talking.
I stayed way longer than I thought I would because I was there for 18 years.
18 years. We're talking with Phyllis Green today, talking about her history with the Forest Service and the national parks. I'm Walt Lindela, Frieda Wara in the studio here as well. Phyllis, you're talking to us from the Copper Country. You're up in that way. I'm from that area. I'm from Chassel, born and raised there. I've never been to Isle Royal. I've been on the Ranger, the boat, but I've never been to Isle Royal. What would you tell me to get ready for a visit to Isle Royal?
It's not, unless you kind of cocoon yourself in the luxury of the hotel and full service restaurant and everything that's there. It's not an easy park to visit. You've got to figure out your transportation, whether it be by the plane, the seaplane, or boat. And if you're going hiking and backpacking, cell signals don't work very well, if at all, anywhere on the island. There's just some spots where you can get out. And to backpack it, you need to be reasonably experienced or plan the trip so that it's a comfortable short hike and you can enjoy it fully, because it's an island on basalt rock. It's hard on your knees. It's gorgeous, but, you know, people go, oh, I can walk 7 miles easily. Well, and I'll go do 10 or 12 out on Isle Royal. That doesn't work very well.
And Phyllis, you certainly know the people that think that they can go out there and kayak it pretty simply. That's a whole other ball game, too.
Yeah. There are a number of kayakers. And for the most part, we only get the more experienced ones. People don't realize that if you have a problem and a medical emergency, that you're most likely going to end up in Canada because that's our closest resource. Although now I am retired, so you're going to have to get the latest information from the new superintendent, Denise Schwenk, and I'm sure she'd be happy to tell you kind of how things are shaping up in the future. But Because right now you can't get to Canada from, I don't believe, on a medical emergency, but you probably need to check that out.
So, Phyllis, I do have to ask you this then. You kind of touch on it with a medical emergency, but it kind of ties into this next question is, how was working on an island in Lake Superior? How did that affect your work? What was good? What was bad? And how much flexibility did you have to have?
Well, in the Park Service, you have very little flexibility when it comes to regulation policy and kind of the sideboards that you operate on. But as far as managing the park and deploying people and getting work accomplished, you have a lot of autonomy. And you need it on an island because nothing ever goes as planned. We usually had like 4 plans for the day based on weather because sometimes you just couldn't get anywhere. Sometimes you could hit the north side of the island, other times the south side. So it's very complicated logistically because you have to have all the material down to the last screws for a project if you're doing a building. And just getting new hires like the trail crew that's coming on, they've got to get familiar with the fact that they can only order food once every 2 weeks. And it all comes in on a boat, and then it gets connected to them in lots of different ways, mostly by boating into the nearest place with a refrigerator or a freezer. So just keeping people supplied. The supply chain to that island is highly complex, is what I will tell you.
You shared with me one time also that the fact that the park, because of the shape of the island and really the archipelago of islands there, that in a sense you had 3 cities. You had Rock Harbor, Mott Island, where many of the Park Service are staying, and then the far western Windigo. So trying to manage 3 satellites, keep those balls spinning. That had to be a lot of work.
Yeah, actually, the communication was just as problematic as logistics because we were pushing the technology, whether it be the radio waves or satellite phone technology, to the max. It's gotten better in more recent years, but literally, if I were talking to you, it would be like talking to a swarm of bees with the static sometimes. And so you had to be able to think on your feet and just find ways to make sure you could communicate well with people.
I'm Walt Lindela in the studio with Frieda Wara, and we're talking with Phyllis Green, taking a look back on some of her time with the Forest Service, with the National Parks. We're talking about Isle Royal. What stays really in the top of your mind as memories? Tell us a little bit about some of the things that you remember, maybe a favorite spot on the island, whatever it may be. What's really at the top of your mind about some of these, about being on Isle Royal?
I think the thing that sticks with me the most is when you make the time to go to that island and slow down to the pace that it operates on. And it's really, you're back to kind of the basics of looking at what's going on in the weather, determining how safe you can be when you're out there, and just enjoying the sheer pleasure. But probably the most satisfaction is seeing the change in the people who do take the time to visit it, because it's not easy to get to. I can remember we had a group of inner city youth that were on a work detail, and they got, I saw them coming off the boat and they looked totally bored. They was like, where'd they send us? Why am I here? And they were there. And I happened to be there like 2 weeks later when they were headed out the door, and one of the young women saw a visitor drop trash on the, you know, kind of fell out of their pocket when they were stuffing it back in. It wasn't totally deliberate. And she just went, she used a bunch of words I wouldn't use, but it was kind of her nature and background. And she told the person to pick that up right now, because I've been working on these trails and they need to stay pristine, you know. And so to see that transformation in a 16 or 17 year old from kind of abject apathy of the, when they walk off the boat, to a passion for the park is the most rewarding work. And working with people who are volunteers or donate money to get projects done, that's the most heartwarming type of experience out there. On a personal level, I can tell you, though, I'd come off the island and usually have to meet with hires up on something complicated or whatever, but as long as you go back for Isle Royal for island time, all was for the right causes.
You mentioned how you want to work someplace where you can make a difference, and the projects that you and your 18-year tenure there were able to accomplish. Just give us a little bit of a list of some of those and the depth of what it took to get them to completion.
Yeah. Well, the funny part is someone once told me that, the federal government works in dog years, so what takes private industry a year might take us seven. And I had an agenda that was pretty complicated, so I stuck it out until most of them got pretty well done. And one was to reduce the carbon footprint of the island through converting our electricity, which was all generated through diesel fuel, and get a hybrid system so that your diesel fuel usage was minimal, but you use solar. And so that took two huge donations from a foundation that has an odd name. It's called National Parks Concessions Incorporated, but they were a nonprofit. And they actually donated close to $2.7 million, and I used innovative legislation out of the Department of Energy to bring that project online. So the Windigo End and the Rock Harbor End are solar hybrid systems, and they greatly reduced our diesel bill. I also decided that I could possibly help industry and the island, if you will, by engaging on aquatic invasive species prevention. And I had the pleasure of working with the National Parks of Lake Superior Foundation in trying to raise money to get an emergency treatment system for ballast water. That's the water inside of ships that's been moving a lot of the organisms around. So we embarked on a pretty lengthy journey, close to $2.3 million in grants with the foundation. We didn't quite close the door on that because we have continued to try to get EPA, and I'm speaking now for myself. I am a retired federal government employee, so my perspective only represents me. But we were definitely trying to get industry to find technology and use technology to prevent transfers, and we did develop a process that we could kill organisms in the tank on a emergency basis, and we made great strides in developing a technology using lye or sodium hydroxide for a freshwater fleet. So there's still some work that I may engage on in post-retirement here, but we made huge strides in that. So those are kind of an island picture and then a bigger picture work that was done out there.
We're talking with Phyllis Green today on our podcast. I'm Walt Lindela and Frieda Wara here as well. Phyllis, you've decided to get involved with the foundation. You've decided to become a board member. Tell us why you've chosen to get involved.
Well, one thing you have to, after you leave federal government, kind of take a time out before you join in any efforts that reflect on the work that you did do. But this is a group of really fun, excited people who are looking at all of the parks across Lake Superior to see what they could do to help them achieve their top priorities. And so for me, I'm still working on the educational film project, kind of on the other side of the fence with the foundation. So, and it's focused on the wolf transfers from Canada and the U.S. to the island to repopulate the island with wolf packs. So that was a kind of an unfinished job because we want to be able to tell that story to school children across the country, and it's been a real pleasure to have the opportunity now, after my time out, if you will, to participate in that type of project development.
But that is also where the National Parks of Lake Superior Foundation came in again, like with the ballast water, to help with a project that the Park Service themselves couldn't exactly get it finished.
That is for sure. Basically, Park Service has to allocate money based on priorities, and they had given us enough money to start the Wolf Project and get a good start on it. So we had the money to move, hopefully 8 to 12, but we had really bad weather. Three trips had to be canceled or adjusted in trying to capture wolves. And as a result of that, the last effort that we had put on was to acquire wolves from Mitch Pocotin Island on the east end of Lake Superior. And we were able to transfer the alpha male, who has a mate basically on Mitch Pocotin. But basically we had achieved our minimum goals and we had separated the two alphas. One with the male on Isle Royale, and we left the female on Mitch Pocotin. And we didn't know if she was pregnant or not because of the conditions. They had kind of eaten them. It's a smaller island, and they had kind of eaten themselves out of large prey. There used to be a caribou population on that island, and they were able to decimate it pretty much in less than 5 years. And the province of Ontario had actually removed about 15 of them to other islands in order to try to preserve their caribou, their woodland caribou on Lake Superior. So they were happy to see us and work with us and actually did most of the field work to capture those wolves. But we were also supporting their effort financially to do it. And so when we had to call a halt, I felt wonderful that we'd moved the minimum of our goal, and I felt kind of awful on a personal level because we had left that female on Mitch Pocotin. And so I talked to the foundation chair at the time, Sana Mehring, and I said, Sana, you know, here's where we're at, and we're flat out of money. And she goes, well, you know, we can make a difference. And she went out there and foundation board members, and they got us some money. And in less than 3 weeks, they were able to raise about $80,000, which put us back on the path to acquiring all of the wolves that we could find that were on Mitch Pocotin. And the second to the last wolf that was caught was that alpha female. And we never could tell based on her activity when we tracked it via her radio collar. We thought she might have denned up in that first year, but we couldn't tell. And as it turns out, she indeed was pregnant, and she indeed had at least two pups on the island. So that's where people who care make a huge difference. It's pretty wonderful.
Well, it certainly has been wonderful chatting with you today. I mean, you've shared a wealth of your information and your knowledge, and your passion for what you're talking about surely comes across, because with Frida and myself, we love to talk about getting outside and enjoying this. And that's really one of the driving factors for you, hasn't it been?
Yes, I couldn't have found a better place to work, because my office window looked right out onto the Rock Harbor Channel. And being outdoors, my commute was great. It was a quarter of a mile along balsam fir and roses.
Fantastic. Well, Phyllis, thank you for your time today. I think, Frida, that's going to cover it pretty well, don't you think?
Fantastic. It's just so good to know the career that you've had and how you continue to give your very best to our amazing outdoors. Bless you.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing your time.
Not a problem. Have a great week.
Well, Frida, that's Phyllis Green. We certainly appreciate her time with all that information, and it is really something, isn't it?
It's got to make you want to go to Isle Royale.
It does. And she's in the Copper Country. I'm from the Copper Country. I've never been to Isle Royale. I think it's time.
And the other national parks are just waiting for you, Walt. Pictured Rocks, Apostle Islands, Grand Portage, and of course, all that you know about your dear Keweenaw.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, thank you for listening in today. I'm Walt Lindelaw.
Frida Wara.
And we'll talk to you again soon. Bye-bye.
The National Parks of Lake Superior Foundation, NPLSF, is the only official nonprofit 501c3 fundraising partner of the National Park Service for all five U.S. National Park sites on Lake Superior.
To learn more about NPLSF projects and programs, you can visit the website at nplsf.org or friend them on Facebook.
I'm Frida Wara.
And I'm Walt Lindelaw. Thanks for listening to the Lake Superior Podcast.
This this podcast made possible with the support of the National Parks of Lake Superior Foundation and Media Brew Communications.